these interviews only on Access Sacramento. And we continue with Mark Danner. Once again, this may contain explicit descriptions of actual torture and is not suitable for children or sensitive adults.
Incontestably true that there were many people in the administration who believed in the theory that you just set out, which is the attacks of 9/11 showed that the political status quo in the Middle East, which is to say the set of autocracies that the U.S. had supported for many years in Riyadh, in Cairo, in Amman, that political status quo could not be allowed to continue because it essentially threatened the United States. That the groups that attacked, the people who attacked on 9/11, were people who were frustrated with that status quo, had tried to change it by attacking the Saudi regime, the Egyptian regime, etc., had been rebuffed and had decided to attack what they called the far enemy, which is the Americans who supported the Saudis and supported the Mubarak regime, etc. The only way to change that threat was to offer a new model, a model for a democratic or at least somehow representative Middle East. I think people like Paul Wolfowitz and others in the administration certainly believed that. I think one can overstate the degree to which they thought it was possible to start a democracy in Iraq, but they certainly believed that you had to shake up the status quo in some way. I think they also believed, you know, you mentioned Israel, I think they also believed that in overthrowing Saddam, they would be adding to Israel's security by securing its eastern front, that Saddam was the major threat to the Israelis, and that this would make them much more secure. So I think there were a lot of motives for the war. You know, we're used to talking about governments like they're one person. You know, why did the government do this? But of course, very often in a large policy like this, there are several different motives coming from different directions, all of which serve to push it forward. And I think the democratic or liberalizing Middle East motive was a real one. I don't think it was determinative. I think you had people like Rumsfeld and Cheney signing on who were, I think, rather more skeptical about this idea that you could democratize the Middle East, but who believed in much more traditional terms that Saddam was a threat to the Persian Gulf, and that threat had to be removed at some point, and it was best to do it in this window of opportunity that 9/11 had provided. 9/11 was a window of opportunity because it made it possible to persuade Americans to support a war of choice. So I think there were many different motives, but I think that was certainly one of them. The problem is, if you accept that as one of them, you also have to accept the fact that it's gone in the opposite direction. That if this was supposed to be an example, the example is
really messed up.
Yeah, really messed up indeed, as The Economist says.
Okay. Yes, please.
Hi. My question has to do with two things that you brought up. Namely, we need democracy in America, and that 9/11 was a window of opportunity for the war in Iraq and everything else that's followed, the torture, the Patriot Act, and all the destruction that's followed and all the deaths of civilians. And that is the fact that this administration is an illegitimate administration that came to power through illegitimate means. They were installed in 2000 by the Supreme Court. This is a known fact that is widely ignored by the mass media. 2004, it's very clear that that election was rigged and that Kerry was the clear winner. And the information on 9/11 being engineered prior is also very clear. The Twin Towers came down by controlled demolition. This is the law of physics. You know, if you look into this information, it's true. Building 7, completely omitted from the 9/11 Commission report. The leaseholder admitted that it was a controlled demolition. I think these are the most crucial truths that aren't being discussed in the controlled corporate mass media and aren't being discussed here, and I think that's the reason why they remain in power. And my question is, why won't you look into this information? There's people like David Ray Griffin, who's authored the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Other scholars like Mark Crispin Miller, who wrote Fooled Again, who explain point by point how fascism has taken over this country, over our federal government, how they rigged the election, how they engineered 9/11. And my question is...
Can we let Mark respond to this?
Because
sure. Well, you made a lot of points. I covered the 2000 election in Florida and also the 2004, and it was rather fascinating. I wrote a little book about it called The Road to Illegitimacy. So I tend to agree with you about the legitimacy question. The Bush administration took power having won 540,000 fewer votes than its opponent. My view would be very strongly that the process that it went through, the Supreme Court intervention, was extremely unfortunate, and I would agree, illegitimate. I think this should have been decided in the House of Representatives, which probably, by the way, would have brought the Bush administration to power in any event. I think it was very difficult, given the scenario, for Al Gore to have taken power, no matter which way you try to figure out how that would have unfolded. And the 2004 election, I think, is a much more contested matter. I think it's not true that it's completely clear that, you know, that election was stolen. I simply disagree with you. I don't think that's true. And finally, I think what you said about controlled explosions in the World Trade Center and so on is not true. And I've read a lot of what you just mentioned, you know, myself. I've read it. It's not a question of my being ignorant of the argument you're making. I know it. I don't think it's persuasive. I think it's wrong. So I think there's a very good reason why the press doesn't pay any attention to it, because there isn't very much persuasive evidence for it at all. I think that the press has certainly been, in a broader sense, quite constrained since 9/11. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. We have a commercial press in this country. When there's a wave of patriotism, the major organs of the press, particularly the television networks, want to get on that wave because they depend, you know, just to put it in the crudest form, for their livelihood on eyeballs, on the number of people who will watch them. The second reason, and an important one, is the press without a political opposition, and I'm talking about a political opposition at the elite level, that is, Democrats opposing major Bush policies, the press without a political opposition finds itself in a very difficult situation trying to oppose the consensus view. And this is just a fact. It's not a good fact, but it's quite true. The press has gotten a little bit more entrepreneurial over the last 6 months to a year as President Bush's poll numbers have fallen. But I think, you know, I agree. I think the legitimacy problem is a very interesting point, and it, to some extent, accounts for the ferocity of the Bush administration's response to 9/11, and to some extent for Iraq, I think. I think that illegitimacy or the legitimacy problem they were very well aware of on September 11th. They were also aware that they had been warned that an attack was coming and that an investigation would eventually show that to be the case. I think those are a couple of reasons why they reacted in quite the ferocious way that they did. I'm talking about domestically with arrests, torture, wiretapping, all of the things that they did. Part of this, I think, had to do with this kind of very extreme response in recognizing that they were a government that had a legitimacy problem, and they had just allowed the United States to be attacked in the most devastating way in its history.
There's a question, I have written question here, which perhaps is related.
Okay.
Because you spoke, when you've gone round recently talking about your book and about Iraq, there's a kind of frustration in the audience about
definitely
what can we do. And this is one of these frustration questions. Is mainstream media just exhausted or paralyzed? Or is it controlled by the conservative owners? Where is the outrage, is the question.
Where is the outrage? I've heard
who
that heard that question a lot. Well, the New York Review of Books, of course, is owned by, published by Ray Hederman. It's a very small company. It's independent. It's also profitable, unlike almost every other magazine of its sort, like Harper's or the New Republic or the Atlantic. The New York Review actually makes money, and it has its own niche audience. You know, is the press exhausted? What was the other one?
Exhausted or paralyzed.
Exhausted or paralyzed. That's a great
or
choice. You know, the press, one could talk about the press for a long time. I just mentioned one reason, I think, for some of the press's problems, which is the lack of a real political opposition, somebody they can quote. You would have had, I think, a different kind of reporting to some extent during the run-up to the war if you'd had Democratic opposition. I mean, it's important to remember that Democrats supported the war. And that a lot of the liberal intelligentsia, which is to say the punditocracy, the commentators, supported the war. Tom Friedman, you know, the New York Times columnist, supported the war. Jim Hoagland, the Washington Post, supported the war. Fareed Zakaria, all of these columnists and opinion makers, quote unquote, supported the war. And one of the problems with the debate we're having now is that you have this kind of consensus beforehand that means that a lot of people who are now criticizing it have a bad faith problem, you know, particularly when you look at the Democratic Party. The second thing when talking about the Iraq War is that the administration chose its ground very well in making the case to go to war. They made the case on intelligence grounds. And it seems very easy to say now, well, gee, you know, why couldn't the press investigate that and show that it was ridiculous? One of the problems is that they claim to have secret information that the press didn't have access to. You know, it was handed out. You've seen it to some degree with Scooter Libby and others. They were like they were in the position, government officials, like trainers holding up fish for trained SEALs. I mean, the press had to jump and take the little bits of information that they handed out. When you make your argument based on intelligence, saying that, well, we know Saddam has these secret weapons, the press is not in a position to go look around Iraq and try to find the secret weapons. They couldn't do that. Now, having said that, the press did a terrible job. Even with the bad hand that they were dealt, they did a very terrible job. And a lot of this, I think, was less the reporters than the editors. A lot of the things that we point to now, like Mohammed al-Baradei's report about nuclear weapons before the war, I mean, the real problem here was not the WMD as an issue, weapons of mass destruction, because most people did believe that there were chemical and biological weapons in Iraq. The big problem was nuclear. When it was fairly clear before the war that they didn't have an active nuclear program, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, issued various reports saying they didn't have one. And these things were published. If you go back to the New York Times, they were published, but they were published on page A12. And on the front page, you got Judy Miller's pieces about the aluminum tubes, et cetera, which were leaks from the administration. But where's the outrage? Well, as I say, you know, I think it's true that the press didn't do a good job. I think there are a number of reasons for that, having to do with political opposition, having to do with the difficulty of obtaining information from the intelligence agencies and the dominant control of the administration. But I also think part of this has to do with how the press has changed. You know, during the Watergate era, which what we started with here, CBS News was a wholly owned corporation in which, whether it was Dan Rather or before that Walter Cronkite, he had access to the head of this corporation. I mean, go see Good Night and Good Luck and look at Ed Murrow and his relationship to William Paley, who owned CBS and who could say, all right, take on McCarthy. He might not like it, but he had the power to say that. CBS now is a little corporate, you know, particle in the much larger world of Viacom. It's a huge part of a huge corporation. ABC is a little corporate particle in the large world of Disney, and NBC of General Electric. These are, you know, tiny companies, relatively, in enormous conglomerates. And they're essentially part of the entertainment business. And that has changed enormously. There's also no longer a government, you know, up until the mid-80s, these were actually loss leaders. I mean, this is a big subject, but you had government regulation that essentially protected the network news. The network news wasn't expected to make money. Now it's just, you know, another money loser, you know.
I see Tony Blair as a very different person from George Bush, a person of much greater capacities, for one thing.
Much greater what?
much greater capacities.
Don't, let's not put the bar too high. Yeah.
I've never been able to understand why the Blair government or administration was so willing to collude with the Bush administration on this whole matter of matter.
Well, that's a great question. You know, these are very good questions. I'm trying to answer them in less than 20 minutes, which is what they would take at least. That's an excellent question. I think, first of all, I have a feeling he probably regrets that decision now, because it's in essence going to cost him his job and his place in history, such as it was. I think he believed, as many Democrats did too, you know, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, any Democrat who planned to run for president in 2008 was for the war. I mean, the one exception would be Russ Feingold, and whether he actually planned to run at that time is doubtful. I think Tony Blair, along with those Democrats, believed that this would, I mean, he rolled the dice. He thought this was going to be a quick, successful, popular war. And I think that's the essence of the answer to that question. There needs to be a second part, though, which is that, you know, Britain has had the so-called special relationship with the United States, and Tony Blair had a choice to make. Do I want to go with my continental allies, with the French and the Germans, or do I want to maintain this special relationship, which is the source of my power as distinct from the European Union, which makes Britain powerful as a separate force, or do I want to simply fold myself into the EU? And that's a kind of choice that's distinct of party labels. Do you know what I mean? It's distinctive ideology. It has to do with power. And I think he made that choice because it seemed to him to be the smartest side of the gamble, that, you know, this is going to be a successful war. I want to be on the winning side. It will define me as different from the French, different from the Germans. It'll keep the special relationship flowering and strong. And it will lead to my place in history. You know, I'll be the war leader. It's the closest I can get to Margaret Thatcher after the Falklands is you know.
Yes. Well, we've got to stop. That's mean, of course, that's you explain really why historians will never be out of work. Because the whole thing will keep being rewritten, and the conspiracy theories will come forward, and all the things will break out, and people, historians will be always employed.
Copies they will be.
Of The Secret Way to War are available at the back of the room from our good friends at A Clean, Well-Lighted Place for Books, so please allow Mark to work his way back to there to sign. It's a very accessible and a very important read. Next week, the forum is unusual. It will be welcoming the Bishop of Durham from England, N.T. Wright, Tom Wright, and the author, Anne Rice. And I'm going to be in conversation with them about the effect of his New Testament scholarship on her, changing her, shall we say, focus in her writing. We'll be discussing their very energetic careers, as well as the impact of Bishop Wright's writing on her well-documented return to Roman Catholicism. But please note that the forum is at 1 o'clock next week for scheduling reasons, and I recommending arriving early because I think seating will become scarce. And for a donation this morning, you can get a CD copy of any of our past shows featured at the back table. Grace Cathedral is proud to be known as a house of prayer for all people, without exception. Mark, I'd like to thank you again for joining us for a great conversation. I meant to ask you, are you an optimist? I meant to get that in, because you seem a reasonably cheerful person.
Well, it's mostly because I'm never up this early in the morning, and it's a whole new world to me. No, I am an optimist, and I'm so glad you asked me that question, because I feel that, you know, if you look at our politics, if you look at what's going on, if you look at poll numbers and various other bits of evidence, you can see the revenge, as it were, of the reality-based community, that though it may take a long time,
reality comes up and bites you in the end.
Exactly. I wouldn't have put it quite that way in this august house of worship, but indeed, reality does have its revenge. And I think the bright side of the world we're living in now is we're seeing the conquering power of, at the end of the day, of reality.
That's so good news.
That makes me optimistic.
Thank you. We'll see you next time at the forum.
My pleasure.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Me too. Very much so.
The Forum at Grace Cathedral is a live monthly program that takes place in Grace Cathedral's Gresham Hall. This free and public event is produced by GraceCom, the media ministry of Grace Cathedral, and is supported by concerned listeners like you. If you would like to know more about the Forum at Grace Cathedral, you can email us at webcast@gracecathedral.org or call us at 415-749-6308. Thank you for joining us at the Forum.
Coming up next is an excerpt from the movie Gandhi, first aired in 1982. Here, Mr. Gandhi advocates a policy of nonviolence delivered by Ben Kiesley. In 1906, the Transvaal government promulgated a new act compelling registration of the colony's Indian population. At a mass protest meeting held in Johannesburg on September 11th of that year, Gandhi adopted his still-evolving methodology, devotion to the truth or nonviolent protest, for the first time calling on his fellow Indians to defy the new law and suffer the punishments for doing so, rather than resist through violent means. This plan was adopted, leading to a 7-year struggle in which thousands of Indians were jailed, including Gandhi, flogged, or even shot for striking, refusing to register, burning their registration cards, or engaging in other forms of nonviolent resistance. While the government was successful in repressing the Indian protesters, the public outcry stemming from the harsh methods employed by the South African government in the face of peaceful Indian protesters finally forced South African General John Christan Smut to negotiate a compromise with Gandhi. Gandhi's ideas took shape, and the concept of devotion to the truth matured during this struggle.
I want to welcome you all.
Every one of you.
We have no secrets.
Let us begin by being clear about General Smut's new law. All Indians must now be fingerprinted, like criminals, men and women. No marriage other than a Christian marriage is considered valid. Under this act, our wives and mothers are whores, and every man here is a bastard.
He has become quite good at this.
And a policeman passing an Indian dwelling, I will not call them homes,
may enter and demand the card of any Indian woman whose dwelling it is. Understand?
He does not have to stand at the door. He may enter.
I will not allow it.
I swear to Allah, I'll kill the man who offers that insult to my home and my wife. And let them hang me.
Talk means nothing. Kill off your officials before they disgrace one Indian woman. Then they might think twice about such laws. In that cause, I would be willing to die.
I praise such courage. I need such courage because in this cause, I too am prepared to die. But, my friend, there is no cause for which I am prepared to kill. Whatever they do to us, we will attack no one, kill no one, but we will not give our fingerprints, not one of us. They will imprison us, they will fine us, they will seize our possessions, but they cannot take away our self-respect if we do not give it to them.
Have you been to prison? They beat us and torture us. I said that this
I am asking you to fight. To fight against their anger, not to provoke it. We will not strike a blow, but we will receive them. And through our pain, we will make them see their injustice, and it will hurt, as all fighting hurts. But we cannot lose. We cannot. They may torture my body, break my bones, even kill me. Then they will have my dead body, not my obedience. We are Hindu and Muslim, children of God, each one of us. Let us take a solemn oath in his name that, come what may, we will not submit to this law.